time is 6:30. The chair will call the Human Services Committee meeting of January 22nd to order. Ms. Davis, will you please call the roll?
Sure. David Holman?
Present.
Aaron Decker?
Here.
Dwight Frederick?
Here.
Angie Montemiro?
Here.
Gabe Newdo?
Here.
David Arrington? Did anybody hear from David? Okay. Anita Johnson?
Here.
Jacob is, Gensler is excused?
Correct.
And Stephanie Kurubilla?
Here.
Citizens' comments, please come to the table. You have 5 minutes. State your name and address for the record. Seeing as there are no citizen comments, we can close those. Is there a motion to approve the minutes of 12-4-12?
Second.
Okay, motion by Supervisor Nudo, second by Supervisor Decker. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Agenda item 4, resolutions to approve the following county executive appointments. Ron Stevens and Doug Bartz to the Workforce Development Board.
I'll present both of those. Both of these gentlemen are here tonight. Ron Stevens from the Boys and Girls Club. Would it be his first time on the board? He's taking Wally Graffin's spot, who went on to other things within the Boys and Girls Club organization. Boys and Girls Club does receive WIA funding for us, Workforce Investment Act dollars, that assist in employing young adults throughout the year and also are a vital part of our summer youth program. So Ron is here in case anyone has any questions of him, but I would recommend this committee's support for his appointment on the Workforce Development Board.
Supervisor Nudo.
I have a question for Ron. Being involved with the boys' clubs there, is there going to be enough time to attend the meetings and everything?
I look forward to attending the meetings.
Okay. And also, just as many times people disagree with each other, are you going to have any problems with that where you get upset about it?
I don't think so. I think it'll be a good committee for me to serve.
Okay, so you can be pretty... Watch if someone disagrees, you're not going to take it personally and kind of threaten them or anything?
I think it'll be fine.
Okay, I'm just saying that for past experience, that somebody kind of disagreed and you kind of get a little bit belligerent against them on the city council. So hopefully it's going to be better from now on.
Perhaps staff would like to clarify what the purpose of the Workforce Development Board is.
The Workforce Development Board draws a number of members from our community, both representing county and businesses throughout Kenosha County, where we take a look at the employment rates, the current jobs that are out in the market, trying to develop, approve our budget that we spend in the WIA world, and also ideas about developing program for dislocated workers, things on that line. It's also required as part of our state contract, where they require a local board to oversee those dollars when it comes to working with dislocated workers and the other at-risk groups that are unemployed in our community. The meetings are 7:30 in the morning, which allows us to capture a lot of folks before they get into the office. And I've known Ron for a number of years and always found him very easy to work with, and I look forward to our collaborative endeavors together on this committee.
Supervisor Johnson.
I just want to say that I'm familiar with Mr. Stevens' involvement in the community, and I have a great deal of respect for everything that he does for the community, and I fully support his nomination.
Motion to approve.
Second.
All right. Are we approving just Mr. Stevens?
Just
Mr. Bartz?
Right now.
Okay, we're taking one by one. All right. Motion to approve Mr. Stevens was made by Supervisor Frederick, second by Supervisor Johnson. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Chair votes aye.
Oh, yes, for a second. Sorry.
The second approval before you is Doug Bartz, who is here today. And Doug has been with us for almost a year now as our job center manager. February 1 will be his one-year anniversary. This was a board that actually falls under Doug's purview. And John Milosauskas used to be the job center manager who oversaw the board and was on that. So we're just, as a matter of formality, asking that Doug be appointed also as a member of the board. He's been attending everyone since he's been here in Kenosha County and will continue to do so. In fact, he leads the meeting.
So I guess it's only right that we appoint him officially.
So moved.
Any questions at all?
Motion to approve.
Second.
Motion by Supervisor Johnson, second by Supervisor Frederick. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Sorry, I did it again.
No, it's okay.
I caught myself this time, just at the end.
We had a long discussion to go at the last PDEC meeting about how they like being asked first and things like that. So, and it's not about you, but on all the committees.
Supervisor O'Day to the Human Services Board.
This is a reappointment. I believe everyone is familiar with Supervisor O'Day. He is the chair of our Human Service Board, has been a member of that for a number of years, and we've asked his reappointment to that board.
Motion to approve.
Well, where is he?
Motion to approve.
Second.
Motion by Supervisor Johnson, second by Supervisor Johnson. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Chair votes aye.
The next.
We can give you something you can throw.
Yeah.
Sit right by you.
That would help, probably. I don't know. Come on down.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Like Michelle Obama at the inauguration.
I won't miss this at this time.
If he doesn't do it, just whack him in the leg.
Martha Sanchez to the Commission on Aging.
Martha, again, is a reappointment to that committee. Has been a member. This would be her second term on that. She's retired and has been, when she attends the meeting, she's had several excused. I'm not sure if they're related to health or other commitments she has, but in talking to her, she would still like to have her on a committee and use her as a valuable member.
Any questions?
I just have one. When you say several, she missed several.
Her attendance was 14 out of 22.
Over 50%.
Less, well, yeah, she was there over 50%.
Any other questions?
How often do they meet?
They meet monthly, with the exception of maybe taking off in December.
Okay.
Or something like that. It's generally monthly.
But the chair wants it.
Correct.
So it's valuable input. So.
Motion to approve Ms. Sanchez's appointment.
Motion by Supervisor Decker, second by Supervisor Johnson. All in favor?
Aye.
Youth and Governance Committee?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair
aye.
Votes aye. I was trying to.
It was actually Angie Montanaro.
Oh, okay.
Who seconded. So.
She did second it first.
It's.
I know.
Just
I,
yell.
I made a couple motions too, but that's okay.
Sorry. Just yell. I'm sorry. Yeah. The table's longer.
It's just loud.
The next one this evening is Supervisor Noodle to be appointed to the Racine Kenosha Community Action Agency Board. The Community Action Agency Board requires a county representative from each, both Racine and Kenosha. He would be filling the spot vacated by Gail Gentz. If you have any questions, he's located right at the corner of the table, and Stephanie is right here.
Motion to approve.
Second.
All right, motion by Supervisor Johnson, second by Supervisor Frederick. Youth and Governance.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye.
And last but not least is Thomas Frederickson, the continue in his position on the Veterans Service Commission. This would be his third term. And he has attended 15 out of the last 15 meetings. I would ask that he remain on that commission through your support.
Motion to approve.
Second.
Motion by Supervisor Frederick, second by Supervisor Johnson. Youth and Governance?
Aye.
Committee?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye.
Thank you.
I wrote myself a note. That's why I was frantically looking for paper. And then forgot while I was looking.
That's fine. We'll pin it on you too next.
Agenda item 5, 2013 influenza update.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Holland. Thank you for inviting me to give an update on the influenza season for 2012-2013, and you received information that Sharon kindly sent out to everybody. There's been some updates since this particular influenza presentation was sent. It goes to the week of January 5th, and I have current data up to January 12th. So this influenza season seems to be hitting the elderly and very young quite hard this year. And right now it's currently widespread throughout the United States and in the areas of the East Coast where it originated, it's starting to retract and it's moving forward to the West. Everything is widespread except Tennessee is considered regional at this point. And of course the District of Columbia is now at a local level. On the second map, it's a little bit not as red as it is on this map. And of course, California and Montana are also have cases that are reported.
So you're saying your map is redder? Is that what you're saying?
My map is less red,
okay.
As intense.
Because, okay.
Nationally, it still is considered widespread. But as you'll see with the maps that it is starting to, it's crested and starting to come down. And the third map gives you an idea of the intensity within the age of 65 and older. And then the second bar is the 0 to 4 year old age. So those are the ages that are quite hit quite hard. 65 and older, they're usually compromised. They may have other chronic conditions, and including any type of respiratory illnesses that can also compromise them with influenza. 0 to 4, they're also the very young. They have built up their immunity. 6 months and younger are not eligible for the influenza vaccine, so they are exposed to the viruses from the people that are their caregivers, family members, siblings, any other relatives for daycare. The next bit of information just tells you about the data collection with illness, influenza-like illness. And so it's originally it's influenza-like illness. People report their symptoms. They seek health care. The number of cases that are reported are based on reports from clinicians. It can be laboratory specimens. The symptoms, it's generally a fever greater than 100, that dry cough. Anybody ever had the flu in their entire life? You feel like you were hit by a Mack truck. I mean, flu is intense. You can feel ill within 3 to 6 hours. You just become very, very ill. Muscle aches, those body aches, headache, that dry cough, fever, and your hair hurts when you lay down. I mean, that's why I just say it's very an intense feeling. Where a cold is more just respiratory with the nose, nasal congestion, sneezing. Yes.
What defines the difference between the flu and the cold? The body aches and a fever? Just a fever, or what specifically do they look for?
Influenza has the dry cough, typically the dry cough, the fever, and those intense body aches.
Okay.
You really feel very ill. A cold is drippy nose, sneezing, might have watery eyes. It's really kind of congested right in that localized
But no area. Fever and no body aches?
Generally not, unless it goes into a sinus infection or
something
right. else
okay.
that would be more of a bacterial infection as opposed to just the virus.
Thank you.
Sure.
They do have a question.
Yes.
Yes. It seems to me it usually hits in the winter time, this time of year. And look at the map, I notice that they even have it in Hawaii, which is really, they don't have a winter. Why is it always at this time of the year that it seems to hit?
Influenza, generally over decades, was in a seasonal aspect. It really has stretched out. The season has grown larger and longer. When we had the swine flu, the H1N1 a couple of years ago, the peak of the cases were really spring and it continued into the summer and right into the fall. It started like late December and then progressed throughout the entire year that we had cases. That was really an atypical type of season. But the influenza season Many years ago, people were getting their influenza shot around September, October. I mean, if senior citizens didn't get it by October, they were frantic because influenza, respiratory influenza, would start hitting around November, December. Right now, the last few years, it's hit very late. Our season was February, March, which typically is a late season. So it's not as traditional of a season, but typically over a six-month period between October to March. Typically not, but we've had some atypical years. Yes. And just to clarify, influenza is respiratory. It's not the GI bug, although many people do call that influenza.
I wanted to ask, by the way, my son is actually the first one to get a positive result for H1N1 in Kenosha County.
Wow. Aren't you proud?
And did the health department call you?
Yes. And she got a certificate. That's great.
Yeah. And he was taboo. Nobody wanted to go near him for like a month. Yeah. But and he was only sick for like 3 days. And then he had to be isolated, so he was bored
exactly.
to death. But I was wondering about vaccinations. How are we doing with vaccinations? Are we running low? Or
with the actual availability
yes,
of vaccine? Currently, the health department, last I heard, we had 10 doses left. But we have checked throughout our Kenosha County. Walgreens ordered another supply, and also the Kenosha Visiting Nurse Association has adequate supply, several hundred doses. So we have not, the health department has not ordered more based on that there are other resources available. We've heard that providers are getting lower level of vaccine availability, but there is access other places in the community.
Okay, so Walgreens will get replenished, they know they're going to get it right
they
away?
They haven't at this point in time, and when
okay.
we did a search, there are places to order the vaccine, so we could also order. It may be more expensive, but we're always looking to see if we need to be the last resort availability, but there are other providers that have vaccine available. Thought maybe your question was about effectiveness rate with the vaccine. We're seeing about 62% effectiveness of the vaccine, which is considered fairly good, actually. A good portion of the illnesses are H3, which is in this vaccine, but there is also an unknown virus. And so that's at 40% of, it hasn't been in it, and there's multiple viruses that are always circulating. So get your vaccine is what I would be the recommendation.
How many do they put in the vaccine?
Typically three, two A's and one B is typical. Was there another? No? Okay. How is the data collected? It's voluntary submission. We do get reports from laboratories if specimens are collected. And the clinicians report. We do have some other sentinel reporters. But influenza is not reportable to a health department. The only reportable cases are if the individual is hospitalized and comes up with a confirmed case of influenza. But next, that's not reportable. And just keep in mind the provisional data that you've seen regarding the United States or even the Wisconsin or even locally, many cases are never reported. People don't seek care. They recover, recuperate at home. And so the magnitude can be much higher than the numbers are expressing. I'm on the page with activity and some percentages, and that's I wanted to update you. This was as the week ending December 29th, and I have current data that came out Friday last week that it's ending January 12th. So currently the predominant, as I said, is H3 NB currently, and RSV, which is another type of respiratory illness. It's called respiratory syncytial virus. That is creeping up and increasing. Wisconsin overall is considered at a moderate level, and our southeastern region right now is considered at a low level. The activity in our region for Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana is still above a regional baseline, and our activity in the U.S. is still considered above a baseline. the predictive value of positive tests is high, and the pediatric deaths from October 5th to the present date of January 12th in Wisconsin, we've had one pediatric death, and in the United States overall, we've had 29. That's the part that people, that really frightens people when they start hearing about pediatric deaths. And that to me, when I start seeing, hearing about those types of deaths, I want to make sure we have enough vaccine in our community to prevent the severity of pediatric deaths.
Was it a healthy normal child, you know, or was it?
Hard to say. They can have underlying illnesses such as cancer. They could have been less than 6 months. Their antibodies weren't sufficient. It's really hard to say what might have caused that. There are cases, though, that the severity can be, child can be starting to get ill the night before, high fever, and they could be dead in the morning. There are cases of that severity. So influenza is nothing to fool around with. It can overtake your system very rapidly, and that's why vaccination. It's your best defense to give your body some antibodies to build up to prevent getting as sick. You can still get sick. So when people say, well, I got the vaccine, I still got sick. But more than likely, you didn't get as severely ill as you could have. Let's see here. For the positives right now, you see that for influenza rapid tests, the percent positive was 29%. As of January 12th in Wisconsin, it's 27.6, so you can see it's coming down. And in our southeastern region, it's 26.2, so it's coming down. The RSV, as you can see, it's 9.5 at this point in time at December. And currently in Wisconsin, it's 14.4%, so it's rising. And similar in our southeastern region is 14.6. You can see that particular illness, which hits the very young quite hard. With influenza-like illness, the percent in comparison to baseline and threshold in the end of December was 4.5, Wisconsin 3.7%, and in the southeastern region 1.8%. So that's what gives us now currently our low level. In Kenosha County, currently the number of hospitalized cases were at a total of 35. That was as of last week. And in Kenosha County, we do surveillance with our school absenteeism rate, not only for the students, but also of the staff. It seems that the hardest hit was that late December, that first week in January, and then things started cresting. And they're starting to come down in regards to number of cases. We also are in touch with our long-term care or nursing home agencies. We've done surveillance, telephone calls to all the nursing homes to acquire information in regards to number of residents that have been vaccinated, also the number of staff that are vaccinated, and the number of residents that are ill in a period of time that we've contacted. All nursing homes are required by statute to report cases of three or more to the local public health department. That's considered an outbreak. And then we give guidance along with the state support on administering Tamiflu, which is the antiviral, to typically all of the individuals within a nursing home to prevent illness. Cumulative number of positive of influenza tests since October 5th, the H3 was 24% of the cases, and the unknown that I described of the influenza A were 60%, and influenza B is 14%. Influenza B typically arrives a little bit later in the season. And just to give you another picture in regards to elderly and illness, the number of elderly that have been hospitalized, total of the 1,800 plus cases, 1,100 plus were 65 and older, and of those 65 and older, 130 were admitted to the intensive care unit, and the total number admitted to intensive care were 208, and then requiring mechanical ventilation. 31 of the 65 and older were on mechanical ventilation, and those 31 were of the 53 total that were on mechanical ventilation. So you can see it really hits the elderly very hard. Questions? I think the last is just a replication of vaccine that the health department has administered over the years. You can see that gold bar, that was H1N1, with the number of doses that we administered throughout our community. But it gives you a pictorial of the number of doses of seasonal flu vaccine that we've given to our community. Next year, it'll be going down considerably. We ordered about half as much. I think we're only ordering about 700 doses because we will not be administering it to our county employees because they'll be receiving it through their insurance. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is that a no? Huh? Want to move the table? Agenda item number 6, mental health services for children.
Tonight, I thought what we do is take a look at some of the services that we have for families that don't necessarily enter into the court system. So I have 3 presentations set up for you. We're going to start with Denise Jardine, who works for Kenosha Human Development Services and oversees the juvenile crisis unit there and has for years.
Started when I was 2.
And then we're going to hear from Kelly, who works in the Families First program, another program we contract with both of these services, that works with kids that are SED, severe emotional disturbance. She'll give you an overview of her program. And then Ron will wrap it up with kind of an initial assessment we do at the department to capture other potential mental health needs that our families have. But I really wanted to focus what happens with a lot of the kids and families that don't come into our system, because I know you've seen the vast array of services we have to offer once you get in the door, but it's important to know that there still is assistance out in our community and what that looks like. Yes, sir.
So I just wanted to sort of explain to the committee one of the reasons why this is being done this evening is really, at least from a county standpoint, with what happened at Sandy Hook Elementary, we really have not necessarily, not openly anyway, as a county board, delved into some of the issues around gun violence or necessarily youth and mental health services. So what we hear tonight, if any of you feel so led in some capacity, we could have a town hall meeting about this and do something that's a little bit more visible. So just bear that in mind.
Yeah, and just to echo on it, tonight we're really focusing on services to children. And if you want to expand that into what they offer into the adult system, we certainly can have Jim Trushon from Aging and Disability Services come and do a presentation and bring folks that work in adult crisis and things like that to the meeting. So I'll turn it over to Denise.
Thank you. Thanks for this opportunity. It's been a long time, I think, since I came to one of your meetings and talked about what we do. I passed out sort of a brief description of juvenile crisis. It is a service that contracts with the Division of Children and Families. It's a certified emergency mental health program, so we operate under HFS 34, as it's known. What juvenile crisis is a mobile crisis workers 24 hours a day that if somebody calls, we have the option of responding to family homes, the hospitals, police departments, schools, a variety of different places. What we focus on is we get a lot of calls from schools with concerns about kids who may be demonstrating either out-of-control behavior, suicidality. Lately, the past couple of years, we've gotten a lot of calls when people post on Facebook that they're thinking about killing themselves and text to one another. So that's become an area of investigation that we're still not all that good at in terms of actually finding people that meet up with those posts on Facebook. Crisis intervention has gotten really busy, busier over the last few years. With the advent of cell phones, a lot of kids are calling us directly, which is a real change over 10 years ago. So we do have the opportunity a lot of times to talk to young people who are concerned about something. Maybe it's a situational crisis. For a lot of folks, it's breaking up with a boyfriend or girlfriend, somehow being disappointed in something that happens with their family. We do a lot of work with families. I don't think we rarely ever see a child where we don't have contact with the family. We will do everything we can to try to find out who that child's family members are and make sure that we have contact with parents as well. It's not valuable, I don't think, to see a child without intervening with the family. And sometimes kids have a misperception that their family is going to be angry with them or be disappointed in them. Sometimes that is the case, but often what it is a way to open up some lines of communication that maybe weren't there. We do struggle with kids who are being diagnosed with things like bipolar disorder. There's a change in that recently. Now it's going to be called mood regulation disorder, I believe, in young people. And that's kids who cycle quickly through behaviors that can be out of control. Everybody kind of struggles on what to actually do, what's a good intervention for those kids. What we don't have a lot of in Kenosha is psychiatric care that's for children. So if anybody knows of a psychiatrist that's maybe finishing up their residency and wants to work with kids, we'd love to see them in Kenosha. We don't have a lot of resources for that. There are a number of clinics in town that do great work with kids. We have some in-home resources. Shorehaven is a service that provides in-home therapy to families, and PSG does some of that through some of the other resources that we do have. Outpatient therapy, sometimes it's difficult to make that work for families with kids. So are there questions? Am I covering some of the things that you were interested in? Or?
Supervisor Johnson?
I do have a question. I know for quite a while there was a problem with diagnosing what they called bipolar, especially in younger kids, and treating it with the wrong treatment with an SSRI could actually put them into a very deep depression. And I know that for a long time that was going on, and we had a lot of kids reacting very badly to treatment. So has there been any kind of a movement, any kind of an action taken to ensure that the people who are seeing these kids understand how dangerous it is to put children, those, you know, in that certain age group, even young adults, on antidepressants when they're not sure of the diagnosis, or maybe that's not their field? And it, because I think that's probably most where it was, people not qualified to actually diagnose it correctly.
Well, there's a lot of controversy about that, and it's really an evolving field. And I think one of the things, one of the concerns you're raising is why in the next diagnostical and statistical manual of mental health disorders is addressing that by separating out a diagnosis for children from the one that was for adults. There has also been a lot of, and Dr. Sun, who does practice child psychiatry in town, consults to us, and every time she comes in, which is every 6 months or so, the array of medications that are available is astounding. And, you know, she is very concerned about prescribing medications to kids. I think there's always a lot of controversy about the amount of medication. Certainly we see a lot of young people on. And again, what we try to do is work really hard with parents to advocate for them to be educated consumers and to ask questions if they're feeling like that's too much medication or why this medication. So I hope that kind of answers your questions. It's not an area that I have a lot of control over, but in terms of working with families, again, it is something with those concerns that we talk with families about, just the kind of questions to ask their prescribing doctor, physician, psychiatrist.
Sure. Yeah, I think what I'm trying to say is I think that we have a lot of older doctors in town who tend to prescribe and aren't familiar with a lot of the things, a lot of the changes, especially in mental health, just your general practitioners who will write a prescription for antidepressants for young people, not understanding and not following up the way they should on, you know, and not warning the family to watch for these signs and other things that should be happening. So I just think, you know, one thing that we could actually do right off the bat is have some kind of a plan to at least get this information out, even if it's just flyers to everyone's doctors, every general practitioner's office, just to be aware of what can happen to these kids when they're put on medications, and that if a general practitioner is going to place a child on a medication, they should have every possible side effect given to the family to watch for and have them come back and monitor them regularly, which they don't.
Kids are the hardest to treat. Kids are the hardest to treat. And I always drew that line because, especially a lot of times, it's a situational or emotional thing. The problem we have truly is we don't have a lot of psychiatrists for kids. We use Dr. Callahan's group a lot in the scene. There's Roger Memorial or Children's, but it's hard to get them in. So most of the time, you take care of the crisis, you get the family involved, and then if you know medicines are needed, what really should be done is they have to go to those professionals, because you are correct, especially in the young adult. You know, adults have a little bit more tolerance to things, but not kids. And so it's a tricky thing, and I agree with you. I get irate when I see that happen, you know. They can go as far as Milwaukee if they have to, if the child is that sick, but to put them in some kind of crisis that they weren't in before because they just quickly jump on it is wrong.
Well, you know, I've managed studies for even things like desvenlafaxine, and it's amazing because, I mean, even 25 years old can still have that reaction. It's not just the children, it's young adults, too. I still think 25 years old. Kids,
yeah.
A lot of times when they're 18, they're just treated as an adult.
The average age at which a young person leaves their parents' basement is 25 years old. So
just
it's
saying.
Or they
can leave and come back. But I really think the least we could do is help get the information out there. You know, that's an easy thing to do.
Looking at your numbers here.
Supervisor Dodge.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Sorry, through the chair. Juvenile crisis, you have about 235 cases a week. How much time do you get to dedicate to each case?
These numbers are what we call contacts, and they can vary in time from 5 minutes to 7 or 8 hours. So we have a lot of contacts that are also follow-up calls to families, stopping by houses, dropping things off. And it's a struggle, you know, and sometimes crisis workers have to triage. If somebody's calling from the hospital and has a child there, or the police are at a house with something going on there, those will be the first places we go. And then return phone calls might wait for a little while.
That's quite a load, yeah.
And there are two workers on at a time until 11 p.m., and then there's one worker on overnight. I left the office at 6:30, and we had a family in our office doing some mediation with, because there was a big dispute and family conflict thing going on. And then there was a worker out at a home where we had gotten a call that perhaps things weren't being taken care of well with young children in that home. So there could be a variety of things going on all simultaneously. But in terms of mental health, I know that one of the concerns, especially with the Newtown, was seeing children. How do you identify those kids who may grow up to be at risk of acting in a way that's really dangerous and deadly to other people? And I think there's a lot of debate within the profession about that as well. Nobody's really developed a great tool that says, yes, this is how we select those people who are going to act out very violently. So I know, you know, from what I read and the training that we're going to, it's something that everybody's really struggling with in terms of identification of folks who may turn deaf. Because we see a lot of people that are mentally ill that function very well. You know, people that start out, they have a really hard time. It's like any other chronic illness. If you get things under control and the management of it happens well, you know, there could be a long life that's productive and is well managed.
Do we have something in place, for example, especially right after the incident, you would hear a lot of parents talking about situations at home with a child who was emotionally disturbed, and they knew this child needed help, and this child was acting out constantly, but unfortunately not doing anything in a severity to which they could have them placed somewhere where somebody would step in until they committed a crime and the courts took over. I mean, do we have something in place where somebody can step in and
And some of that's going to go on and segue into a lot of the other things.
Okay.
And what crisis does, we tend to see people that, and we work with a lot of the families Kelly works with to develop crisis plans because they may struggle for a long time. But again, those folks who get identified, we could segue to Kelly, perhaps?
So kind of like triage?
Yes.
Okay.
And when we see families that would meet the criteria for Kelly's program, or we may talk to Chris and say, we're seeing this family, they're really struggling. What's available to them through their insurance is not meeting their needs. Is there something else we could take a look at?
So one way to think of this is juvenile crisis is responding to really immediate crises. And they may see the same family numerous times, but they work with them intensely, but they're not going to follow one family for a year and work with the providers closely for a year to get therapy in place, whatever. They're there to more or less to get the crisis managed so no one gets harmed or hurt. And then often people with mental illness, parents are referring their kids to psychiatrists, to therapists, you know, privately, just within the community. And then the segue that Denise is referring to is we have a few areas within the Division of Children and Family Services that are open to the community. And the one that we brought tonight, Families First, works with kids that have diagnoses. And I won't take her thunder, I'll let her explain that. But that's a program that we fund here to help provide much longer-term support for kids who have severe emotional disturbance. And I'll let Kelly explain that.
Okay. I think maybe everyone should just pull up a chair. It's going to be one of those.
We're all here.
I'll just go down to it.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Kelly Panici. I am the supervisor of the Families First Project through Professional Services Group. We are also contracted through the county and located in the Job Center. You had a perfect question because it definitely segues into our program. So Chris is passing out her PowerPoint. Families First has been around since 2002. We are a voluntary service. We help prevent out-of-home placements. We find resources in the community, and we're always looking for new resources. So if you find something or somebody hears of something, just have them call me because we can utilize everything. We serve Kenosha County. We have 60 families currently enrolled. And I have 5 service facilitators that work with those families. So who is eligible? Children under 18. We serve typically 4 to 18. The birth to 3 serves the birth to 3 kids, and then we kind of pick up after that. Anybody that lives in Kenosha County is eligible. We have kids way out on the county line. We're driving an hour to go see them. But they are eligible for our program if they want it. You have to have a diagnosis of severe emotional disturbance. We have kids who are receiving mental health services, which would be a psychiatrist, an in-home therapist, an outpatient therapist. Any of those services would qualify you. If you have an IEP at school, that would qualify you for our program. We do get some referrals from CPS, Child Protective Services, also from Denise, from Crisis, from Juvenile Justice. So we work a lot with Kenosha County and their workers to help find services for these kids. They have to have difficulties in multiple settings. So a lot of kids have troubles at school or at home, but maybe not in both. We typically, our kids have troubles in both, and sometimes in the community. The family and child have to be willing to participate. If they're not willing to participate, we're not going to really get anywhere. So most people that we've contacted do want to participate. We are a voluntary program that really gets them sucked in, because when you feel like you've made progress, you can be done with us for a while if you want. If you need to come back, our doors are always open.
If I can interject, in answer in part to your question, for children who their behaviors are such that they're truly a danger to self or others, then the possibility of out-of-home placement is an obvious choice. But for the children that you were describing who haven't hit that point, but they are becoming more and more difficult to manage, those are exactly the kinds of kids who often end up in the Families First program, because the Families First program brings together all of the players, also provides supervision in the home or supports in the home. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the critical pieces is that when a child's struggling and a family's struggling, it doesn't really help figure out how to improve that situation by just removing the child. It's really more a matter of how can we help you parent better, manage the child's diagnosis and the behaviors.
Right.
I have one quick question. You know, you have to worry about confidentiality, but when you think of a mass shooting, and if there was a child maybe starting at 17 and acting out to 18, 19, whatever, is there any way that there would be a data bank on that person? Because we're trying to find people that in the future could really be a problem. That's the, I mean, besides, obviously this is a fantastic thing to help them today and everything, but we're just taking that example when someone was a troubled person, young adult, and then we had a crisis. I mean, a crisis that took lives. So I just wonder if somewhere along the line you have to not worry so much about the confidentiality if people meet certain criteria. There should be a data bank for these people, because that's how we pick up a potential person. Otherwise, as wonderful as these programs are, and maybe they'll help, you know, 999 families, we're missing that 1,000th, you know, we're missing the one that's in trouble. And if we're looking at a way to prevent that in the future, it's got to be some way that the data's shared, because, you know, that's the only way you're going to find the red flag. So I'm wondering now that everybody's on high alert about this, if maybe people in the field should start talking about some kind of alert bank for these people. You
know, I think that came out when they had the shootings in Virginia at the college campus, and that young man, if memory serves me right, had at least been identified as someone who needed mental health services, but I think was refusing those. So as Denise says, there is no exact science that says if you have A, B, C, and D,
you're,
you know, this is going to happen.
Yeah,
you know, so a database just collects data for you. And it's not going to, you know, you could have two kids with the same diagnosis. One becomes a very productive member and serious about recovery. The other one is living on your streets and bothering people that walk by him or her. You know, so there is no way to pinpoint to say these behavioral characteristics mean your outcomes are this. It means you are, as you said, there's red flags associated
yes.
with those, and can put more people on alert to get more services in there, to look at if they're voluntarily coming in and things are falling down. You're knocking on Chris's door saying we need court intervention here, and as Chris said, that's when you start looking at more restrictive settings if that's appropriate for that kid and the family. So. You know, we collect all that information in her program. They collect it in crisis. We share that information amongst each other. So it's you know, we have the releases and the ability to do that. And we're always double checking. And folks, that Denise and Chris, and who've been in this field forever, you say some family names and they could take you back to, you know, way back when the kid was this high and now they're a parent. So, you know, a lot of local knowledge, and we're fortunate here in Kenosha that we have
yes.
these type of programs and the relationships that we have, not only with our providers, but with the school systems,
yep.
the mental health field outside of who we contract with, have all been very receptive and open to sitting down and having discussions on how we can link better and collaborate more. So, you know, that's a kind of a long answer to not giving you your answer, but we're at work.
But at least it is being done. You guys are doing it behind the scenes, which is
I wanted to speak to the school systems real quick.
Sure.
You know, I had a call about 3 weeks ago from somebody I grew up with who's in my district. I'm a supervisor, and her daughter's in kindergarten. And there's a child that is in her kindergarten class, 5 years old, that comes to school, and at least twice a week, threatens to bring a knife to school and murder all of his classmates.
Oh,
yeah.
A 5-year-old?
5-year-old. And it's really difficult for me to understand. I mean, I understand confidentiality and I understand integration in our school systems, and I understand how we can't leave anybody behind or leave anybody out. But it seems to me that there has to be a point when we have to separate. You know, when that's going on, because, I mean, you think about the damage it's causing to the other. I mean, we're talking about, I know a few of the kids in the class and their parents don't let them watch TV, and they hide their face when the witch comes out on Snow White.
Yeah,
so to have a child come into class and constantly threaten that they're going to, I'm going to bring a knife tomorrow and I'm going to kill you. I mean,
that would be a kid for our program. I mean, it really would be a perfect kid for our program.
Yes.
Because we do work directly with the school districts and the teachers, and we provide support that way. We create a team approach. So we're going to go in and ask the teacher and the principal and whoever else, the school social worker, what's going on, what do you see at school, and then we'll bring the parents in also, have them, I mean, they're the integral part of that team, ask them what services they need, and it's pretty easy to get a 5-year-old involved in our program. They're still, even if they're saying things like that, there's still that little kid aspect to them,
sure.
And they're going to want to be somebody's friend and
sure.
Have somebody look after them.
This person's also, or this little person, is also violent. I mean, they've had to, like 2 weeks ago, they had to evacuate all the kids to the gym
right.
So that they can get a restraining and actually have the police come. And I'm wondering, shouldn't, in that kind of circumstances, wouldn't the school have contacted?
They may have already been involved in crisis. They may be in her
program
right now.
Okay.
So,
you know, and I guess and this is probably a question for the school board, but how long do they keep them integrated? With the other children.
I think as long as they can.
Yeah.
Because
you know, there's a lot of kids that, you know, I go in schools every so often, and sometimes for my own kids because they do their homework at home.
Mm-hmm.
You always see a group around the office where the dean who's in charge of discipline
mm-hmm.
is, and, you know, that kind of goes on. And they do have their, you know, lines in the sands, and they
mm-hmm.
work. If they haven't contacted Kelly or Denise yet, you know, I would imagine they're the next call on there.
Right.
And they go through their checklist and try to keep everything as normal as you can, because in a situation like that, chances are something's happening back in before that kid gets it through that school door.
Right.
So
and
if this person called you and she was the non-parent, could you still go look into it, or does it have to be the parent or the school that contacts you?
No, it can be the parent, the school. We take referrals from anyone. So, but the school would have to talk to the parent and say, "Is this a service that's available? Are you okay?"
Okay.
And then they can contact us and make a referral. So the parents do have to be notified that this is where they're thinking of sending.
Sure.
But anybody can make a referral.
It's such a difficult situation because you think there is a point where these children, all these other children, are being traumatized on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So.
Supervisor Dodge.
I'm on the lighter side. I don't know. I remember, I'd say we've came a long way. I remember in school being traumatized, and having nightmares because we had to get under our desks for nuclear attack tests and warnings. The alarm would go off, you had to get under your desk and put your head between your knees as if there was going to be a nuclear attack. Yes, in school. We actually did that. So we've come a long way.
Like that would have helped.
Yeah.
Just to sort of let the committee members know, there is one member of the school board in particular who does know that we're sort of taking a look at this and has said that any way that they can be helpful, to just let them know, and we can partner up with them if we wanted to do something publicly. So continue.
So how do we become involved? We kind of talked about that. There is a referral packet that we fill out. It's 2 pages, and then the parents sign a release allowing the whoever's making the referral to send it to us. Parents can make that referral on their own. It doesn't have to come from the school. We've had lots of parent self-referrals. They're just struggling and calling around for extra help, and they found us, and we're a good fit. We gather all the supporting documentation. So if it's coming from a school, we do ask if there's an IEP in place for them to include that, so we kind of know what they're working on. Any diagnostic information, if they're seeing a psychiatrist or an outpatient therapist, if they can gather that would be great. We send it along. documentation of functional impairments. The family is contacted regarding the referral made. I'm the one that contacts them. I explain the program to them and what we exactly do. If they're interested, then we proceed with the referral process. I help them gather whatever other information I might need, and we go to a screening committee. At the screening committee, it's kind of informal. Chris is on the screening committee, so we just go over each case that is being presented. If they fit into our criteria, we accept them. If they don't, then we make a referral to another agency in the community. So they're not getting forgotten or left behind. They're going to get services somehow. So then if they are accepted, they are assigned a service facilitator who will contact them and set up an initial appointment. There's a whole stack of releases that parents sign, so if there's any services their kids are already involved in, we can contact them and start forming our team. And then we also let them know about the other community resources. I've been to a lot of intake appointments where parents had no idea these things even existed in the community. So there's a lot of things out there that if you don't need them, you don't know that they exist. So we're definitely helping spread the word about things. We create an assessment, which I like to call a really long questionnaire. It's about 12 to 15 pages long, just a big history of the family, the child, the kids, other kids in the home, any problems that you're having, any other services, anything. It's just a whole history of what's been going on. We create a plan of care, which is goal setting, with the family. So we're setting things to work on, what services they want, what kinds of things they need to improve on. If their kid is having a lot of issues in school and being truant, that's something that we're going to help work on them with. We find community resources, and then we create our team. So if they're not accepted, we send information to a different agency and help facilitate that transfer. And then our wraparound process. So we develop a team of support for the family, which is all the identified service providers that the family is working with, and then any informal supports. We really want to hit on the informal supports because at some point we're not going to be around. We want you to be able to do this on your own. So we set a team meeting, invite all participants. We discuss everything that's been going on with the family, good, bad, or ugly. We talk about it all. I always like to end my team meetings on a positive note because I want you to leave feeling that we accomplished something and that you're going to want to come back. So that's kind of how our program works.
Excellent. Could you possibly provide this to me in an electronic copy if I give you my email address?
Sure.
Sharon can send it out.
Perfect.
Great.
In here you have that. It's so the kids that are participating, they have to, all of them have to have a severe emotional disturbance. Okay. And then
we have made some exceptions if you're behaviors are significant enough and maybe you just don't have that diagnosis yet. If there's multiple people referring this child and there's big issues, we're definitely not going to turn you away.
Is this program for that specific person or is it for the whole family?
We usually identify one client within the family, but we work with the whole family.
Okay.
So if there's another kid in the family that maybe isn't as severe but still would benefit from a psychiatrist referral or some in-school supports, we're going to work with them too.
Okay.
But also with the family members too, how to deal with the issue?
We do a lot of our in-home therapy providers do some sibling groups. So if they're having issues trying to figure out why their sibling is acting this way, they can go to this group with other siblings and figure that out.
Supervisor Frank?
Do you deal with kids like that going through, with parents going through a divorce? Is that more so than...
We have a lot of families where the parents are separated or are going through a divorce, and we've had lots of prolonged divorces, so we do work with lots of families going through that issue.
Supervisor Johnson?
I'd just like to say this is great, and I think I'm a big advocate of educating people about what's available to them. I think that's half the battle. So I would think even just coming up with some kind of campaign to get the information out to everybody to help spread it somehow, I mean, that would be the very least we could do, because, you know, I believe you stated a lot of people have no idea these things are available.
Right. We have a lot of contact with the school district. A lot of our referrals do come from the school district or Rogers inpatient or St. Luke's inpatient. The school districts have copies of our referrals. If they have any questions, the school social workers call me directly to see if this child is a good fit for our program or if there's another one that we could suggest that would be a better fit. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the schools know that we're out there and utilize this quite a bit. So,
are those the school social workers? Are those our social workers? No,
they're certified or FBI.
Maybe I could jump in here and just sort of tie this thing together a little bit, how this all this works. Unless you had any more questions for Kelly, if you didn't want to cut her off. Sorry. This was okay. You know, what we've done through Kenosha County with the support of the county board and the support of this committee is build really a system of care for kids and families. And what's really unique, and that's what I want to sort of stress for a minute, is the fact that we have a program like Families First, or that we have programs that take children's long-term support waiver, are ways that we can help families voluntarily before things get so bad that they have to get involved in a juvenile court system. So what's really unique is that in the Families First program, that what they're offering there is this team approach, this strength-based approach, where they can help guide a treatment plan. You have a child with special needs, a severe emotional disturbance, that gets you in the front door, but you're really involving the whole family. So it's not unusual that as her staff are working with families, they're seeing parents that are very stressed because these are tough kids to parent, but they also maybe see parents that could use some help parenting, or they could use some other help. They may have some mental health issues. So those goals for the children are also goals. They also will have goals in their plan of care related to the parents, or perhaps to helping the family find better housing, or just basic economic goals. They really look at the family as a whole, with the goal being that if we support that family voluntarily, and with the support of the county board to fund a program like Families First, the goal is things won't get so bad that those kids need to be taken out of their home and placed in care, like for significant behavioral issues, or things won't get so bad that children get abused or neglected because parents are so frustrated with what's going on. And that's really the idea behind crisis, too. And crisis is going out in the community and helping to get people connected back into community services and getting things before it reaches a horrible boiling point where people are harmed or kids harm themselves. And what's really unique about Kenosha is that juvenile crisis, although they work with mental health cases and they do some child abuse and neglect work after hours, they debrief with the Child Protective Services supervisor every day, Monday through Friday, to review cases they've touched the night before. And through that process, we then often make referrals into programs like Families First or, you know, crisis can do that. So we have a system that talks to each other and shares information. And then what I'm bringing you here is just an example of a tool that at some point, if kids really need more than voluntary help or and they get involved in the juvenile court system, then all of the county social workers have been trained in this child and adolescent needs and strengths assessment screening tool. And so Chairman Holman, when you were asking, you know, how do you tell if kids need more mental health services, every child that gets placed into foster care, whether they are a little child, a six-month-old, or a 17-year-old, there's two versions of this. There's one version for the very young children. I just gave you a copy of one for the older kids. This would be like age 5 to 17. And I didn't bring this whole tool here the entire, I just gave you a couple pages to give you a sense of it. But all these first two pages literally are areas that all of the county social workers had to were trained in 2 years ago, and they have to be recertified every year, annually, to administer this. And what it is that every time a kid comes into foster care, and then every 6 months that they're in care, you have to measure them, and you have to assess, and I'll just point out a couple of the areas. On the first page, the box in the upper left-hand corner is trauma, and that's sort of a historical record of did the kids experience trauma in their lives. And you score it 0 through 3, and there's a key explaining, you know, what is it. 0 is what you think. They didn't experience that at all. 1 is a small amount of trauma, 2 more, 3 is a higher level. And then if you go down this page, there's life functioning, and that talks about, you know, some of their medical needs, any legal needs. But I'll on the first page, if you look on the right-hand side in the middle of the page, there's children, youth, behavioral needs. They talk about psychoses, impulse hyperactivity, depression. And so if there are symptoms of those problems. And so our staff then score this document at the end of, and then the second page talks about strengths of the child. And it also talks about, you rate the caregiver, the foster parent who may have the child in their home, and also then the biological parent that you're hoping to return that child to. And you relate, you see what strengths they have or what strengths they don't have. And at the end, you get a score, and that helps our staff then know, oh, I've got a child with some special needs. I need to make a referral to maybe to see a therapist. I need to make a referral for a psychiatrist. I need to have someone do a more full-fledged assessment of mental health needs. And so we're doing that now with every child that comes into the foster care system, whether they come in through child welfare, where they're removed because of abuse and neglect, or whether they're coming in through juvenile justice. And occasionally, we do have, in our child welfare system, we will have a case or two, and not that many, because I think our voluntary services are very good. But every once in a while, we'll have a case where Families First has worked with a child for quite a bit of time, and things are not getting better. They're getting worse. And then we have an internal staffing process, and because Families First is contracted with us, we invite those parents, we invite the caseworker in, and we've had cases where we've gone into court to get court supervision of a child like that so that we could place that child in a treatment setting that they need, so that that child doesn't hurt themselves, hurt other people, hurt their parents. But what's wonderful about Kenosha is that we've put a great system in place that by the time, you know, you have Kelly or Denise calling us up saying, this is a kid that we need to staff, I don't think this is working, it really is a kid that needs that more extensive treatment, because most kids are responding to the voluntary services and they're getting better in the community with their families, you know.
Supervisor Decker.
What percentage, you said most kids are getting better with the treatment. Do you have a percentage? I mean, is it like 90%?
Well, I think Families First success rate is in the 90s.
Yeah, it's pretty high. I mean, so because we are a voluntary program, there's no time limit on our services, so you can be in as long as you need our help and want it. So we do have a lot of successes.
Good.
Yeah. We measure their successes, you know, were there any referrals for child abuse neglect, were kids kept in their home, you know, we're using those sort of concrete measures. I remember, I think 2 years ago when I looked at some of those stats, they were in the low 90s to upper 80%, so it's very good. They're unique. That program is very unique. It can have families in there a year and a half, 2 years. Other families, not as long. It really depends on the need of the family.
Supervisor Johnson.
So what would you say are your areas of greatest need?
Well, the one need, and you said it earlier, Kenosha doesn't have a great, really solid child psychiatrist in the community. And we really could use improving that. People are going to receive. Rogers Day Treatment so far has just, they have very qualified staff, they're very good, but they really just work with kids that are in their program. Mm-hmm. And they haven't opened their doors to other kids in the community, at least not yet. Mm-hmm. There is a program that the state is going to start in the first half of this year for children in foster care, where they're going to, they're bidding out a proposal to bring a provider in to provide better health care and mental health care for kids in foster care and improve vision care and dental care. They're using the kids that go into foster care are placed on Medicaid for health care insurance. That's the way you get health care to kids in foster care, because you're taking them away from their families, so they may fall off their parents' insurance, or their parents may not have good insurance, but every kid in foster care gets Medicaid. This will be a different Medicaid benefit that they hope will improve care. My hope from that initiative is, once it starts, is that they may actually bring into the community more child psychiatrists that I'm hoping, this is Ron Rogers speaking, this isn't in the proposal, I'm hoping that some of those people may open their doors to take other kids that aren't in foster care at some point in the future.
Have we done anything like offer to subsidize somebody going back and getting further education to cover children? Have we looked into anything like that to get people to actually take in some of the providers that we have? To see if we can, you know, kind of somehow get them to go and get the training necessary to deal with children?
Along the same lines, have we approached any of the hospitals or medical groups about bringing in a child psychologist?
At different times, I've talked to one psychologist from Aurora, and at that time they weren't interested.
So I suppose we would need both psychologists and psychiatrists for therapy and prescribing. And
part of it has to do with the reimbursement rate of Medicaid, frankly. Mm-hmm. It's not real high. And people really, they question whether they can they can run their office at that low rate of reimbursement. And then, that's really the biggest issue.
There is a child psychiatrist in Aurora that works in Kenosha, and her name is Dr. Anna, very long Russian last name. Yeah. Some people can say, I haven't memorized it. And she's somebody that the people have gone to her have been so pleased with what she does, but she's one person.
Yeah.
So really, other than Dr. Anna here in Kenosha, there isn't another psychiatrist that's open to taking things like Medicaid and being very available within the city limits. So there's been discussions with Children's Hospital, and they're trying to expand through Children's Service Society, which is part of them. But again, it seems like things sort of start and then they fall away, and we consistently not have
And I know the community health center, Jack Waters, I've had conversations with him. We had a meeting before Christmas about his wanting to expand services in the mental health field. As you know, that is a federally funded center, so they are entitled to a higher reimbursement rate than the person who hangs a shingle up in downtown office. So he has began discussions with us at the county level. We certainly haven't broke that out saying, he knows we need child psychiatry, but we haven't said, let's focus on that to begin with. They've been very preliminary discussions. But I think with their expansion and what they've done over here on 63rd Street, that there's some possibilities too there where we could maybe get some more services.
There's some outpatient counseling right now with children. They go to a psychologist there, but again, psychiatry isn't very good.
Because you would think, yes, it would probably be difficult to get somebody to focus 100% of their time and receive Medicaid for it. But if we could get certain people, and I can think of quite a few doctors who are very fantastic, would offer to commit, say 15-20% of their intake to Medicare patients, Medicare children, who need, you know, I mean, not focus all of it, but a certain percentage of it, help them get their or certification.
I mean, the reality is we've always been behind in child psychiatry. It's not like we had it before and we lost it.
Sure.
Yeah, in the 25 years that I've done this, that's the one place you want it differently. But the real reason I think that may have started is everyone had the idea that Children's Hospital would help. And initially you could get them in a little quicker. Now you really can't. You know, that got inundated and that was just cut off without anything in its place. So I just know that that's lacking.
Well, it's not only lacking on the children's side, but we're beginning to start feeling a shortage on the adult side when it comes to psychiatry.
Awful.
So
it's
awful. And I think that's a nationwide issue. I don't think that's just a Kenosha specific issue, right? Certainly when we go around to other counties in the state, they have the same experiences and difficulties. Dane County may be in its own world because they have a med school there and you know, and feed folks through that. But it's psychiatry, our psychiatrists are talking retirement, some of them, you know, in the next year or two, and we're like, well, find somebody to replace you, please. You know, so
is that just a lack of interest in the field? I mean, is there something?
Well, I'm curious, like the fact that you're within two major metropolitan areas, that it's much more lucrative to be south of here and practice in Lake County or
gotcha. So it's our geographic location. It's not a okay.
Right. And you made a mention of that several meetings ago, Dr. Monroe, about the difficulty of getting doctors regular MDs.
We're half the number in primary care, and we do a lot of the psychiatry, not the bad stuff, but I mean, 75% of what walks into family practice has a psych overlay. You know, so it's just how it is. Mm-hmm. It just is. But many years ago, I mean, we used to have Bennett Lake, we had the Fourth Fort, St. Catharines, we had psychic connection. Mm-hmm. And then it left us.
It left because it wasn't big. It wasn't money.
And now they'd probably be making a ton of money. Who knows? But it left us.
What I want to leave you with, though, you said that is a need, child psychiatry. On the flip side, we in the county did quite a bit to offer therapy for kids and families. That's something that we continue to fund some of that through our DCFS budget. Mm-hmm. So it is not unusual that when families don't have, whatever their insurance is, maybe they have some insurance, but they really can't get into a good therapist. We do have an in-home therapy team that can work for 3 to 4 months with a family. These are licensed master's level clinicians with a good supervisor that can work with parents, work with kids. We've had Children's Service Society of Wisconsin, which has now been bought, so to speak, by Children's Hospital. Mm-hmm. They opened up a clinic a couple years ago. They expanded to two therapists, and they work with a lot of our kids now that are in the child welfare system. Very good. So in some areas, we're making some inroads. And, I really appreciate the support of this committee and the board to keep these services going, because when I talk to people in other parts of the state, they don't have an in-home team that they fund that can go out. And literally, I mean, if we have a kid with a really need to get someone out there right away, I can get someone out there tomorrow if it's really an emergency. And that's something that, you know, it takes support of the county board to do. But what it's doing is preventing children from maybe harming themselves, preventing children from being hurt by their parents because things are so chaotic and difficult at home. And I know Families First uses those teams as well, and I know that Denise has made referrals to those programs as well through juvenile crisis. So our goal is to get services in to help kids and families, to improve family function so kids don't get hurt, don't hurt other people, don't hurt themselves, and don't end up in the juvenile justice system or end up in the juvenile court system because of child abuse. Right.
One quick thing, we do have good children counselors. Kenosha does have good counseling services.
We do.
We do throughout the city. That is a true fact. We just don't have psychiatrists.
I think we're going to have to start being like the pro football teams and going to colleges and start recruiting people and bringing them here and showing them how wonderful Kenosha is. And showing them the need, and because you know what, you could actually put up a sign on your door and have a lot of business right off the bat.
You're right.
So I think that, I mean, even just letting students know that we have a huge need here and they'd have a startup practice could be useful.
Just to go back to something you had mentioned when I think Denise or Kelly was talking about prescription drugs and getting word out about the abuse there. We just, as of a week ago, through the Division of Health, we'll be receiving or applying for a grant that the state put out to 9 counties in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Kenosha being one of the 9, where they identified prescription drug abuse as being a major problem. And that'll be working with age groups 12 to 24, 25. It's not providing programming, it's mm-hmm. getting education and words out, talking to the doctors, the hospitals, the pharmacists, and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we will be pushing that forward. Our application is due at the end of this month. And then they have a fairly quick timeline on when they like to see things start up. And it runs through 2015. I think we're all but assured that money right now. We'll be back in this committee talking about it and asking approval to accept it. But that'll be a lot of education.
Nationwide, the DA and the federal are starting to follow this. Wisconsin still isn't on board completely. So that's why it's still a little bit, the whole state is... the state of Wisconsin hasn't started yet, and other states have. January 1st was supposed to be the startup date. They're going to follow the scripts because there's a ton of Percocet, OxyContin, morphine out there, so they're going to start following these scripts.
We don't follow them?
Honey, you have no idea how bad we've been. We've been bad for a long time. I learned a lot in the last year. So, yeah. But Wisconsin hasn't started yet, but it will soon.
Yes,
so then that will be your bit.
Like,
yeah.
So if I don't know if you have any more questions for me or anyone else who presented this evening.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It was wonderful.
All right. Thank you.
I left some of my business cards on the table that I shared with you. So
they're wedged underneath.
Emails a great way to you.
Also,
Kelly,
with us,
do you have business cards?
Is there anything that you can think of that we can do to help?
Agenda item.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Agenda item 7. Such other business is authorized by law. There is none. 8. Committee member comments. Anybody? Susan Garin. Okay.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Motion by Supervisor Nuno. Second by.
Either one.
Supervisor Jacker. All in favor.
Aye.
Aye.
Ladies, would you like to
contact information?
Vote.
There's a motion on the floor to adjourn.
Second?
No, aye.
Aye? Did somebody already second it? I'm like, nobody seconded it.
I like that she told you how to vote. The chair votes aye.
Or nay, sorry, or nay.
Did you ask Stephanie?